Last time on Appalachian Mysteria, Sarah and I visited High Rock and saw that the cliff where Alex and Megan jumped or fell doesn't even appear to be a good place to commit suicide. The jury for Megan's trial was chosen quickly, and the proceedings began that same day. We introduced Megan's defense attorney, Stephen Tully, and the state prosecutor, Lisa Thayer Welch. Stephen Moon took the stand, explaining that the cemetery where the Stevens family dog was found was one of Alex's favorite spots for peaceful reflection. On the stand, Moon said that even though Alex had been suicidally depressed in the past, he firmly believed that his mental state had been improving. Christopher Biggs, the EMT who took Megan to the hospital, testified that Megan told him Alex had slit his own throat and collapsed into a stream. "This is probably not going to look good," she told him. "My prints will be on the knife." On this episode, Megan is interviewed three times by police, and her final story differs from the others in at least one significant way. We hear testimony from three witnesses in Megan's defense, including a former boyfriend whose name was strangely familiar to Teresa. All three witnesses have the same potentially crucial detail to add to the narrative, but can anyone prove it? From Chromatic Media, in the heart of Morgantown, West Virginia, this is Appalachian Mysteria, Season 2, Big Savage. During the first 48 hours that Megan was being treated at the hospital, for what exactly we can't be sure, she was interviewed three times by the police about what happened at High Rock. Together, these interviews last for hours, but we've recreated the most important 10 minutes of her first interview using verbatim transcripts of the recording. While we've had to edit the amount of content for time, everything you're about to hear occurred in exactly these words in Megan's first police interview with two detectives in her hospital room. The original tapes were played in their entirety for the jury.
Okay, today is Wednesday, January 4th, 2017. It is 12:19 p.m. I am Master Trooper Schramm here with Master Trooper Mason, along with... Can you say your full name for me?
Megan Virginia Schaefer.
You guys hiked to Hightower?
Yeah.
Where's that at?
In Garrett County.
Garrett County, okay.
We hiked up to the...
When you say we hiked, what do you mean by we?
Myself.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Alex Stevens.
Okay. Alex Stevens?
Yes.
Okay, who is he? I mean, is he...
He's just a really close friend.
All right, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you guys were hiking up to the high tower. What happened?
He took some stuff with him, like ritual stuff. I didn't understand it, but I knew he needed me there, like, for support. I didn't really understand.
What kind of ritual stuff are you talking about?
I honestly wasn't sure.
Okay.
I know it's really...
Oh, no, that's okay.
Yeah, so we hiked up,
Mm-hmm.
He had me carry a kitchen knife.
Okay.
I guess for, like, branches or anything that we come across.
You say a kitchen knife?
Yeah.
What did that knife look like?
Like a butcher knife.
Okay, so you carried that.
I carried that.
Okay.
I walked on the left. He held my hand. He walked on the right and carried his cat.
So he had a cat with him?
Yeah, and a cat carrier.
And a cat carrier, okay.
I also carried a bag up the hill. It was really muddy, and we walked all the way up to the... There's a an old abandoned house where there's a chimney.
Okay.
With rocks and stuff, and that's where we went. And he set up the candles and the cat, and he said some prayers and stuff. And, like, well, before he did prayers, I'm so sorry. He was like, "All right, take off your clothes." And I was like, "Okay, sure, okay."
Okay.
But there was no sexual assault or, as previously asked me, no coercion or anything like that.
Okay.
Coercion, sorry. He was a really good friend, so I trusted him, and I knew he needed me there for support or whatever. So then after that, we didn't put any clothes on, and we walked to the edge of the cliff just to see down. The rocks were slippery, and at this point, he had handed me the knife, so I had the knife, and I fell with the knife. But by the grace of God, it didn't cut me or stab me or anything like that. We laid there for a few minutes. The drop was about 20 or 30 feet through some bushes. We laid there and both of us screamed for a little bit because it hurt. And then,
Can you explain the fall? Okay, you guys walk up to the edge of this cliff and stuff. Both slipped at the same time, or did you?
Yeah. Feet came out from underneath us and down we went. We got up and couldn't get back up, you know, the cliff.
Mm-hmm.
So we started walking down the mountain to kind of like find where we were, and we held hands most of the way down. I believe I carried the knife the whole way down as well, because he stated that he thought he had some broken ribs, so...
Okay.
I took the knife to help him out a little bit. We were both naked. It was wet, rainy, and dark. We fell around maybe a little after 7 p.m. So it was very dark, and we hiked down the mountain, and he just kept telling me that, like we weren't going to die and that everything was going to be okay. And he kept telling me that he loved me because I was crying and screaming the whole time because it hurt, and I didn't know what was going to happen, and I'm sorry.
It's okay.
And, we made it to the stream, and he just kept telling me, "We're almost there," and I knew. He knew the park better than I did, but I didn't know exactly where we were going.
So, what happens at the stream?
He tells me he loves me, and that... Sorry.
That's okay.
He tells me he loves me, and I told him that I loved him too, and he told me always, and I told him always, because we had a really good trust bond.
Mm-hmm.
And he tells me that he's tired of all the suffering, and that he suffered all his life, and that the will to live was more important than the will to die, and that I had the will to live. Then he puts his knees in the stream, and I knew there was nothing I could do to stop him, and he slit his throat. I want to say twice. One time small and one time really deep. And the knife fell in first and then he fell.
Okay. So you're saying he kneeled down next to this stream.
Like face, so like his face would fall face first in the water.
Forward facing the stream, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
No, that's okay. So when he sits, gets on his knees, forward facing the stream, where was the knife at this point?
In his right hand.
In his right hand. How did he get the knife?
He asked me for it.
He asked you for the knife?
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't realize exactly what his intentions were going to be.
Okay, I understand. So you're saying he slit his throat and you said twice?
I don't believe that it was very deep because he did it again. And it was extremely deep the next time, and he yanked it back, like he was, like, pulling a lawnmower, and then the knife fell, and he fell. And I got down on top of him.
Okay, you know we've had this type of case before, and sometimes people are afraid to say, but there's no shame in saying, was this like a suicide thing?
I didn't realize that it was.
I mean for you.
No, gosh, not for me. I just knew he needed me there for something. But I didn't realize that he was gonna go so far as commit suicide.
Did he ever talk to you before about that?
Not really, no.
Not really or no?
I mean... I knew he was, like, upset with some things, you know, but...
Like what type of things?
I mean, He didn't like where he was in school because he didn't feel like he belonged there, and his dad had stage 4 lung cancer.
Okay.
And, but I didn't realize that he was torn over it.
Okay.
Or else I wouldn't have,
Yeah, I mean, because you're telling the story about going up there, and you guys walk over, you say some prayers and stuff like that, and then you guys all of a sudden walk over to the edge of this cliff.
Just to, like, see.
And holding hands.
Anything, I just didn't, I didn't realize.
Yeah.
I don't think that his intention was to fall.
Did you guys jump?
No, I did not jump. I didn't. That's not smart. Not smart at all. So no, I wasn't going to jump off a cliff willingly.
So, I mean, let me just ask you right out front. You had no intentions of killing yourself.
No, I did not.
I told you there were going to be some tough questions. We're not trying to attack you. We're just trying to get the truth. That's all.
I completely understand, and I'm willing to give you the truth 100%.
Did you do anything to harm Alex?
No. No.
Is any of his injuries from you?
No, I would never hurt him.
Megan's second interview was nearly the same, so we're skipping over reenactments here. But again, let's take note of a few details worth mentioning. You just heard Megan tell the officers that Alex had taken her up to High Rock the day before all of this happened. Later, she tells them that Alex had burned a bag full of stuff then, too. Officers found a video of that bag burning at the top of the cliff, but neither the prosecution nor the defense submitted it as evidence in the trial. We filed a public records request for that video, but haven't received it yet. It may show nothing of interest, but we're hoping to find some little details that can help us make sense of what the ritual meant to Alex, and whether Megan seemed to be an onlooker or a participant. If it turns out to be interesting, we will definitely play the sound for you in a later episode. When questioned about her relationship with Alex, Megan says that she met him 3 months before High Rock, when she started working with him at Ruby Tuesdays. She said they hit it off and would often hang out after work. They were apparently together a lot. Megan also tells detectives that she did not benefit from Alex's death, which prompts the police to reveal yet another confusing new detail. They tell Megan that when the investigators arrived at Alex's apartment the day he was found dead, they discovered the paperwork for the $188,000 money transfer neatly piled in plain view on a table. On the top was a sticky note with Megan's personal information, including her social security number. In other words, all the details Alex needed to fill out that paperwork. When police tell her about finding the paperwork, Megan responds that Alex had asked her for her information for the transfer 2 weeks earlier, citing family strife as a possibility for his desire to change the beneficiary. She says she didn't know how much was in the account or even whether he had actually finalized the transfer. All of this is confusing for two reasons. If Megan had been responsible for the money transfer, why have the paperwork out where he could see it? Why leave it in the apartment for police to find? And why would she need to write down her own information on top of it? Wouldn't she need all of Alex's personal and account details rather than the other way around? And wouldn't the paperwork be in her handwriting? But if Alex was responsible for the paperwork, why did Megan not see that it was completed since it was sitting in plain view? And why wouldn't she think of it when police asked her whether she benefited from his death? As for the events of the night in question, she continues to maintain that the ritual was designed by Alex, that he hadn't explained the details to her. She repeatedly says that he wanted her there for support, though we do know that she also brought things to burn, specifically her karate uniform and belts, because, quote, "I don't participate anymore, and I don't like what that system stands for." Megan says that she and Alex went to High Rock from his apartment, where they had packed up all the stuff they brought with them, including the knife that killed Alex, which he had taken from his own kitchen cutlery set. She maintains that she and Alex slipped at the precipice of High Rock, an accidental fall. She says that during the walk from the cars to High Rock, Alex seemed positive that he was singing songs from his youth like "I Walk with God," and that he had been, quote, "showing me more about religion and stuff, because I'd never really been into it," unquote.
She says he never mentioned suicide to her, that night or previously. Even after they fell, she said, he was encouraging her to keep walking through the darkened, freezing forest and that everything would be okay. It wasn't until they got to the stream that he suddenly decided to die. But again, why lie about this? If you plan to cover up a murder as a suicide, why not paint the victim as suicidal? Or at least say he mentioned it one single time. It's so bizarre that it doesn't make sense either way. One final note about the second interview. In Megan's car, police found a small note in her handwriting that simply said, "I am not your soulmate." Megan tells the officers that it was written a long time ago and did not refer to Alex. When they asked who it was about, she answers, quote, "One of my friends that I'm just really close with now, Doug Widows." Witness, Doug Widows.
We know that Doug Widows shows up in her hospital room very soon after she's admitted, very soon after Alex's body is found.
But you know Doug Widows because he's been in the news previous, correct?
I recognized the name right away, so I looked through some of our old reports and found that actually Mike Sawyers had interviewed Doug Widows over a year before Alex was found dead. And totally unrelated. There was a 16-year-old driving home from work, bad weather, slid into a creek, her car ends up upside down, she's trapped, and Doug Widows and another guy show up because they just happen to be in the area. They see this and they pull her out of her car. We interviewed Doug Widows at that time. He received, he later received an award from his employer, FedEx, for this heroic act. And we interviewed him again at that point. There are social media photos that show Doug Widows and Megan belong to the same gym. If you scroll down far enough on Megan's Facebook page, there is a post where she posts another selfie and Doug Widows responds something like, "Ooh, you so hot."
And her mother, like Doug's
mother. Doug's mother additionally comments on Megan's Facebook page that,
right,
how pretty, there's my girl, how pretty. Again, he shows up in her hospital room soon after all of this happens. He reaches out to one of his friends who's a retired police officer, asks that guy to go talk to the police who've already interviewed Megan, and that results in a third interview.
We're going to close this episode with that third police interview with Megan that Doug Widows helped to arrange, but for now, let's jump into his testimony at trial.
So Doug Widows Jr. is on the stand, and he had been dating Megan for a time, and they broke up, and this was before she and Alex had a relationship. And Doug Widows is a flaming ginger. He clearly works out. He's wearing this sweater that he's chosen to emphasize his build. And he says that he and Megan have known each other for a while. They dated. Now they're just friends. He's a criminal justice recent graduate, right?
It said on his, I believe his Facebook page still states that he's a criminal justice major.
Well, he said during his testimony that when Megan told him what had happened, he didn't believe her. And that she started crying and telling him what had happened and what she'd told the police. And he was like, "You need to tell the police what actually happened."
Right.
That he was trying to push her into, look, Alex is a bad guy. It's okay to say bad things about him.
Yeah. Widows also said that Megan looked like she was scared to death.
Right.
When he saw her.
He was concerned that she was going to get herself in trouble if she wasn't telling the truth, that it was going to be obvious that she wasn't telling the truth. And he seemed really nervous during his testimony.
His face was bright red
the entire time. It just kept getting redder and redder. I mean, it was matching his hair.
Right.
And he was wearing a maroon sweater, so he's just like all up in the red right there. And he was just so defensive during his testimony that even at one point, Tully was like, these aren't trick questions.
Right. Yeah, he was remarkably defensive.
He was like, can you rephrase that? Like, he just didn't know how to answer. He acted like everything he said was going to make Megan look worse.
Or make him look bad.
If being defensive in a murder case sounds suspicious, we should probably mention that he may have felt there was good reason to be a little nervous. We've already talked a little bit about the circumstances surrounding that first big story that Teresa and Mike Sawyers published about the case.
And someone posted on our Facebook link to that story, hey, check out Doug Widows, he's her boyfriend, he'll be charged next. I removed that post because Doug Widows contacted us and asked us to take it down. Normally, I would have left it up because we keep information that has been made public, and if the people don't like it, which happens all the time, it's news and we leave it there. But this wasn't an article we had written. This was an outsider's comment saying Doug Widows was guilty, and at that time, I had no information saying that he was at all connected to this case, and I thought it was only fair to remove the comment, so I removed it.
Yeah, so when Welch takes the redirect and starts questioning Widows, she referred to the statement, I guess he had talked to the police and he had said, Megan was with me more than that Alex kid and she was fine. And that he saw her enough and he didn't think there was anything wrong with her. That he didn't pick up on anything of her being scared or being abused. According to Doug, Megan told him that when she hit the ground, she was unconscious. And in all of the interviews that she did with the police, every single time she said she was conscious the entire time.
Right.
That
right.
She wished she'd been unconscious. Yeah. So her story wasn't really matching what she was telling Doug versus what she was telling everyone else.
Or at least Doug's recollection, or what Tully finally choked out of Doug.
And just to be clear, we still don't have any reason to believe he's connected to this case other than his appearance at the hospital soon after Megan's admission. And while talking about that hospital visit, Widows claim to have witnessed what is probably the most heavily disputed assertion made during this trial, something that all three of Megan's defense witnesses claim to have seen with their own eyes. On Megan's back, Widows said he saw a large cross that had seemingly been carved by a blade.
Seen this man hanging out with the family. We didn't really know who he was. And right after the testimony of her ex-boyfriend, Megan, during the break, was just right behind him. He was still sitting, and she took her finger and she traced it from like his ear down to his clavicle, like just touching his neck, and he looked really uncomfortable.
I was really uncomfortable watching that, yeah.
I was uncomfortable too, and he made eye contact and he looked down. He looked ashamed. But up until that point, we weren't sure if they were dating or if he was friends with the family or whether he had just been one of her friends that was at the Y.
Right, was he a cousin? Was he a relative? Yeah.
But that pretty much solidified that this is her new boyfriend.
Yeah, and then there were moments where he would put his hands together and look up at the ceiling and looked like he was wanting everybody to know he was praying.
He looked almost beside himself for most of it. He looked like he was 2 seconds away from crying. Like, if you were to talk to him, he was just going to lose it. He was very, very visibly upset during this whole proceeding.
Witness, Kristen Logsdon.
So Kristen Logsdon took the stand, and she's been friends with Megan ever since they were freshmen in high school. She had blonde hair. She was kind of like Megan in that she looked a little younger than she really was. But she claimed that she saw Megan in the hospital that Wednesday. So this would be like her first day of being in the hospital. And Kristen said she visited her that day and that she saw that there was a distinct cross cut into her back. And when they asked her to describe that, she used her fingers to sort of trace like the entire spine and then the cross across the shoulder blades. And she said it was pretty fresh, that it had just scabbed over.
Didn't she say that Megan needed help getting in the shower?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, she was helping Megan, and she saw it, and she didn't ask Megan about it.
Right. But she assumed that Alex had done it for, quote, mental control, end quote.
Yeah, and that's when she started crying.
I felt like it was a very dramatic production. I felt like it was rehearsed. I felt like her entire testimony was rehearsed. There was also a moment where Tully asked Logsdon whether Schaefer initially told her about her relationship with Stevens, and Logsdon replied, "I don't remember." So how much did she really know?
Yeah, because she calls Megan her best friend, but she also said that Megan stopped talking to her after she started hanging out with Alex, and she didn't know if they were dating or not. She didn't even know the scope of their relationship.
Right. At one point, Welsh is reading a report she said that showed Logsdon, after the High Rock incident, during a police interview, said she liked Stevens and he's super nice. So she questioned her about that.
But she did say that she considered their relationship abusive, whether they were friends or lovers. She said that it felt abusive because Megan was cutting her friends out.
Right.
During the court proceedings, Sarah and Teresa naturally paid attention not only to the people on the stand, but to Megan's expressions and reactions to the testimony being given, or her lack thereof.
She ended up crying a lot during her testimony, and I was watching Megan watch her, and Megan just was stone-faced the entire time.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a bizarre situation.
That felt weird to me.
Yeah, that felt weird to me as well.
I would feel really weird if my best friend was crying on the stand trying to save my life. I don't know that I would be able to sit there and just, like, watch it like it was television.
Right. I think I would start crying as well.
Witness, Danielle Foy.
In contrast to Kristen, Danielle is not pasty and pale. She's very tan. She has long, dark hair. She's very attractive. You can tell that she puts a lot of work into her appearance. Like, her nails are manicured. Her eyebrows are drawn on. I mean, she's very meticulous. She kind of seems like she's got some sass to her. She's got some attitude, whereas Kristen was kind of meek. Danielle is more, let's do this.
Yeah.
And apparently, so she's met Megan at the gym. I guess they all went together to the Y, and that's where the videos of her powerlifting are actually taking place. And I think she said she'd only met Alex once. But she said that their relationship was really one-sided, and that whatever Alex needed, Megan was right there, but she wasn't really getting that reciprocated. She said at one point, Megan's phone wasn't working, so she had to go to Megan's work, which I'm not sure which job that was necessarily, but she said that Megan was crying and acted scared and was just avoiding her questions. She did mention the cross carved into Megan's back, and she described it as being scabbed over, and she said it was fresh and new.
Foy also said that she saw Megan cry because Alex needed her attention. And she said that was unusual because Schaefer doesn't cry, period.
Yeah, I do remember her saying that. That there was out of character that Megan was tough. There was a point during the redirect where Welch kept referring to Danielle's statement and asking questions and trying to get her to admit that she described Megan as a power lifter, black belt and feisty. And like I said before, Danielle said she doesn't use the word feisty, so she wouldn't have said that. And then Welch points out a part of her statement where she talked about Megan not changing after meeting Alex. And Danielle protests and says that she was changing was what she actually said. And so they kind of went back and forth on that. And then Welch was like, here, it's on page 11, if you'll just take a look at it. And Danielle's like, no, I brought my own. And so Welch is like, what do you mean you have a copy of your own statement? And
you could feel the flames coming from Welch at that moment.
Yeah, like it was a great moment because she was pointing out that Danielle had already been coached on how to talk about this in the stand by her own lawyer. And it just made the whole thing feel really phony. There was nothing genuine about it. She was like, no, I have a copy of my own statement. And I think that showed how good a lawyer Welch really was.
Yeah, I think so too.
She picked up on that right away.
I think the jury paid very, very close attention at that moment to that dialogue and that awkward moment of, wait a minute, what? Where'd you get that? Where'd you get that record?
I mean, is that inappropriate for some reason? Because I feel like if I was a lawyer and I have a client who's going on the stand in court, priority number one, keep them from saying anything that's going to get themselves in trouble. And the way you do that is to keep their story consistent. And the way you do that is to provide for them the statement, which is their intellectual property that they already made. You know, I feel like that's what I would do. Like,
but the point is, Welch made sure that the jury knew from her perspective, it was a big no-no.
Whether or not Danielle was exercising her rights, it didn't matter. What the jury saw was that she's so afraid of incriminating her friend, she hired a lawyer to make sure that she could represent Megan's best interest because she was afraid she couldn't do it by herself. Like, that's what I saw going on.
After Doug Widows talked to Megan that second day in the hospital, he convinced her to give a third interview with police. Megan tells them that she needs to clear a few things up. She tells them that she had not been completely honest, hoping to protect Alex Stevens. At the edge of the High Rock precipice, Megan says that Alex turned to her, told her that they needed to jump, that everything would be okay, then leaped off the rocks, holding her hand. More importantly, when they arrived at the stream, Alex instructed her to hold the knife out in front of him. He tried to fall on it, but when she started to pull her hand away, he grabbed at the knife, putting his hand over hers and cut his throat twice, just as she'd already described. At the beginning of the interview, Megan tells this story in a high-speed fit of tears. Afterward, the officers slow her down and take the story back to the moment they stood at the edge of High Rock.
Could you see the bottom of the cliff?
No, but I didn't feel like I had an option.
Okay, where are you standing? To his left or to his right?
I was to the left.
You were to the left of him, so you are holding, are you...
Holding the knife with my left hand and holding his hand with my right.
And what all does he... What exactly does he say to you from beginning to end?
He just tells me that we have to jump. He tells me we have to jump, and then he jumps and I go with him.
When you go with him, did... It's okay. Did you jump, or what happened?
I mean, I don't know. He jumped, and I just kind of, like, went, you know? You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't...
Like, he pulled you, or did you...
Yeah, he pulled, but it wasn't like... He didn't throw me off, you know what I mean? It was just like he went, because he was holding my hand, and I went with him.
So, did you physically propel yourself forward, or
no.
not?
No.
So, it was just his body weight pulling your hand?
Yeah.
What did he say would happen when you jumped?
He said that we would be fine.
Okay.
And then... the cliff, like... why the hell would you be fine?
When you walked out there with him, did you suspect that he was going to tell you to jump?
No.
Now, I don't want to be too presumptive, but somehow there was something said. What was the dialogue between you holding the knife and him kneeling in the stream, and what did he say to you?
He told me he loved me.
Okay, take your time, Megan.
I'm so sorry. He told me that he had suffered all his life and made me hold the knife out, and then he fell forward, but... I went to pull it back because I didn't want it to happen, but when he was already falling, but he pulled it back and then pulled it across again.
I just think there's clearly parts that are being, I want to say, overlooked. So he comes to the stream and you two are facing each other?
Yeah, he made it to the stream a little bit before I did.
What did he say to you to make you hold that knife out?
He told me that I had to hold the knife out. He just told me I had to do it. I was scared and cold and I didn't want to die. And he was like, there's no way he's going to let me not hold the knife out. Do you know what I mean? Like, I had no other options. He made me hold the knife out.
Were you mad at him for what he did to you?
I was just scared because I was hurt so bad. I was fearful of my own life. That was it. But I never wanted him to die. Never wanted him to die, but I was very afraid because of how in pain I was and how cold I was, and I didn't know where I was.
Did you ever drop the knife and tell him to do it himself?
Like, in fear for myself. Like, I couldn't argue with him about that because I didn't know. If he pulled me off a cliff, what else would he have done to me if I wouldn't have went through what I could have ended up in the stream with him?
Were you supposed to end up in the stream with him?
I don't know. I don't know. I'm just really grateful that I didn't. I don't know if that was intention, but I knew he wanted to die.
Had Alex ever talked to you about suicide before?
No.
Had he ever talked to you about depression?
Yeah, I knew he had been depressed, like, throughout the Coast Guard Academy and stuff like that, but I didn't realize that he had carried through in this sense.
Why did you decide to call us tonight and disclose this?
Because I was just like, you know, one of my friends was like, Megan, you're not okay. And I was like, you know, like, I need to talk to the investigators because, like, it looks really bad on me. And I know, but, like, I wasn't, like, I didn't want to portray him to be a bad person either. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to portray him to be a bad person. That would, like, hurt me, or that would, you know, put me in danger. So that's why this is really important. Like, I was out in a really bad situation, and then I know it looks really bad. I just need to clear the air.
Okay. You had mentioned earlier, how much was the... when you became a beneficiary to his account, how much was that worth?
I didn't know.
Okay.
I have no idea how much it was worth.
Why did he make you the beneficiary?
Because he told me he trusted me, and he didn't want, I guess, anybody else to have access to his account, because he trusted me.
The three testimonies you've heard for the defense constitute all of the witnesses that knew Megan personally. The only detail they add about the physical events surrounding the death of Alexander Stevens is their unanimous sighting of this cross carved into Megan's back. Much of the jury's decision in this trial depended on how the jury viewed the relationship between Alex and Megan, and the cross carving, if true, suggested physical abuse. Is it possible that Doug Widows, a criminal justice major who's put himself into harm's way for others and supposedly urged Megan to be honest with police, would that Doug Widows conspire to commit perjury with two other witnesses in a murder trial? It seems unlikely, but that's what had to have happened if there was no cross cut into Megan at all.
Yet there were no photos, any medical expertise offered on the alleged cross carving.
They didn't even have Megan, like, pull up her shirt, like, nothing.
On the next episode of Appalachian Mysteria, we get a detailed view into the psyche of Alex Stevens as his therapist takes the stand. Quantum suicide, astral projection, and reincarnation all come into play, plus the state calls a witness that had a strange encounter with Alex right around the time he was making Megan the beneficiary of that investment account. But will her testimony work out better for the defense? Special thanks to Michael Wozniak and Gina and Chris McLaughlin for helping us to recreate Megan's interviews from the transcripts. Appalachian Mysteria is a Chromatic Media production. It was produced by myself and Sarah James McLaughlin with lots of assistance from our co-host, Teresa McMinn, and courtroom reporting by Jordan Carter. If you find yourself liking the show, take 2 seconds to rate it on your podcasting service. It makes a difference in helping others to find good stuff. If you haven't listened to Season 1 of Appalachian Mysteria about the WVU co-ed murders, make sure to check that out as well. The music for this show was written and recorded in Morgantown, West Virginia by John Smithers, Nick Larson, Annie Stroud, and Nathan Snyder. You can connect with us and others about the case and view updates as any become available at the Big Savage Facebook page. You can follow Chromatic Media on Facebook, Instagram, or on the web at chromatic.media. That's K-R-O-M-A-T-I-C.media. Stay tuned. Thank you.